Applying Cool Tech, number 15. In the office with me today, I have Bill Penrod from the University of Louisville and Yaroslav, say your last name again.
Jazowski.
From what part of Poland?
From Warsaw.
Yaroslav, would you tell the listeners about what you're doing here and your experiences in Poland, and not the experiences you were just talking about.
I'm here in Milwaukee, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, working for the Vision Program with Milwaukee Public Schools District. So I'm an itinerant vision teacher working with children from kindergarten age through 21. I'm also attached to MPS's assistive technology core team, where we're basically collecting software and hardware for students with a variety of disabilities. Recommend all those tools to teachers and parents. We also go out to schools and provide the services both for staff and the students on how to use adaptive equipment. But I'm also taking classes through University of Louisville, and I'm in a vision program. And right now, my visit in Louisville is connected to a class I just almost finished in orientation mobility.
And you're working on your doctorate, did you say?
I have my doctorate.
You already have your
doctorate. Yes, I already have it. I did my doctorate, I completed in January 2002. And my doctorate basically is in teaching computer communication to students with visual impairments. Though there are some aspects of also language and concept development and social integration.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a sort of multidisciplinary dissertation.
And you're going to use this information in back in Warsaw to work with the students there. Is that your plan?
Well, I use some of that. Because I got United States in 2003, so a year after I completed my PhD, but I worked there in School for the Blind, something like KSB here,
mm-hmm.
outside Warsaw for 8 years. So I used assistive technology really extensively, mainly computer technology, and access to the internet and digital text.
And you were telling me earlier that most of the people in most of the schools there are using Macintoshes. I was a little surprised to hear that.
Oh, in Milwaukee public schools.
Oh, in Milwaukee.
Yeah,
okay.
Not in Poland.
Okay.
No,
okay.
No, in Milwaukee. In Poland, it's 99.99% Windows-based computers.
And you were real interested in this Mac OS 10.4 with the voiceover built into it, I guess, for your students in Milwaukee there.
Oh yes, mainly for them, because right now, there was about a year gap or 2 year gap between the last release of Outspoken for Mac. And this new product, with a built-in speech, is OS 10.4. So there's barely anything that I could currently use with my students, especially those that who cannot use screens to get access to computers.
Okay. And Dr. Penrod here is, I guess I've known you for 10 or many years anyway.
Oh, a long, long time, yeah.
And you're the head guy at the at U of L now in the more, you're running the program there now, is that right?
I'm the coordinator of the teacher preparation program and visual impairments, and I'm the co-coordinator along with Marianne Reynolds of the Orientation Mobility Program.
Okay.
AER approved Orientation Mobility Program, I might add.
And what is the significance of that for us lay people?
Well, it's just that, you know, orientation and mobility, and I know, I hope your listeners don't mind my letting them know that you aren't a 22-year-old guy. But I know back when you were in school, you were, might have been taught orientation and mobility by somebody that might not have been certified in orientation and mobility, or at least there a lot of people in your age group had been.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not saying that these folks were not as competent as anybody today. But the problem is, unless there's an accrediting body that says that all instructors have met the minimum competency level for a particular area, then that's a little problematic, because there's a great degree of variance between instructors, even when they're both graduates of approved university programs. Imagine how it is when back in the old days when they. When people were agency trained, and you know they went to the Heinz VA, and they had a few weeks training, and then they came back and started working with school children. But this is a way of standardization and ensuring that our students are served by people that are professionally qualified.
I see. And Bill, you've been in this field for, well, you were at KSB as an O&M instructor previously. Right.
Well, what I was, I taught several summers at KSB, and I was around there long enough over the years that a lot of people thought I was on faculty, but I really wasn't. I've taught there in the summers and that type of thing, so I was only part-time faculty at KSB. I spent an entire career of 27.58 years with Jefferson County Public Schools, and because of that, we interfaced a lot with Kentucky School for the Blind. As you know, today very few kids go to the residential schools for their entire high school, elementary and high school educational program. Usually they've been to a public school and then they go to KSB for a while. They might venture out part-time or a half day at in a local educational a school system like Jefferson County to get, you know, courses that aren't offered at KSB, and then they come back and they spend the remainder of the day at the residential school, and it's an eclectic mix these days when we talk about educational programming for students with visual impairments. Very seldom do you have a person that's completely educated in either the residential school or the public school.
And how did you get into this field, Bill?
Well, to be honest with you, I was teaching at Churchill Park, and I was working with those days what we called trainably mentally disabled students back in 1975, and then the public law 94-142 came into effect that same year. And about that time, looking for a my mother was a school teacher and made me, when she said, "I'll send you to college, but you got to make sure you get certified to teach." So you always have something to fall back on, son. I won't have to worry about it. And little I know, she was kind of right. I got off active duty in 71 with the U.S. Army and went in the Army Reserves, and I did a couple other things. But then I started teaching, and I was working over Churchill Park with these trainable mentally disabled kids, what we now call functionally mentally disabled kids. And I was looking at another way to pick up a master's degree. And it so happened, in some exceptional area, and there were traineeship monies available because of the critical shortage of certified teachers in visual impairment and blindness. And I took advantage of that. And after I got through that, Dr. Hilda Caden, who was my primary professor, and so many people owe her so much because, you know, of her reputation with Braille research and that type of thing. She says, "Well, Bill, you know, you're an outdoors person, and we really need some orientation and mobility instructors." And she hooked me up with two of her good friends, actually three, which was Randall Harley and Sam Ashcroft down at Peabody, and which was the, you know, is probably one of the most prestigious special education preparation programs any place. And also Butch Everett Hill. And Butch Hill was the guy who wrote the Blue Book and, you know, that type of thing. He and Purvis Bonder. So I got a, she helped me get a scholarship there. So I went off for a year in 1983 to get that certification. And I came back, finished up my career with the Jefferson County Public Schools, taught part-time for the University of Louisville, and we managed to get a grant funded to start an orientation and mobility program that somehow coincided with the time that I was planning on retiring with the public school system. So that's basically how that worked. But it's been an interesting career.
Well, can do you have any kind of, I don't want to say tips, but any advice for people that might be our listeners, blind people, on common mistakes that people make in orientation? Or maybe I'm making this sound way too simple.
Well, you know, if I had one piece of advice that would go across an entire listening audience, I would say don't be afraid to get out and use your skills, and don't be afraid to make a mistake, because, you know, that's how we learn. And if you a person needs to do what it takes to learn the skills necessary to conduct their daily rounds,
mm-hmm.
to get up in the morning, plan their day. Actually, the planning of the day started the day before at a minimum, and conduct their days around their work, and then coming home from work. And there's more to the life than just going and coming home from work. You've got to get to the marketplace. You've got to get to the places of recreation. You've got to be self-actualized, and you've got a right to be that. And the only way to do that is through mobility. So I say get out there and travel. And if you aren't satisfied with your travel abilities, get some help.
Talk to us a little bit about electronic travel aids. I know that's an area of interest for you and me and our listeners as well.
It's an exciting time for electronic travel devices for persons with visual impairments now. Exciting time. When I first got out of Peabody back in 83, you had basically the Lindsey Russell Path Sounder. You had the Mowat sensor, you had the sonic guide, and you had a laser cane. And those were the four primary devices, you know, that were available. But the problem with all those devices were they were too costly. The Mowat sensor would do the job as well as the devices that are on the market now. But back in those days, 25 years ago, that was like $500. That was a lot of money 25 years ago.
Mm.
Well, you know, like today, a person with that uses a primary system like a cane or a dog guide can benefit greatly, and it'd be cost affordable with some secondary devices such as the hand guide and the mini guide. I know you've got first-hand knowledge of both of these devices, and they're very, very, very affordable. Very affordable.
Yeah.
And they've been some great improvements. Dr. Terry Terlaw and myself, we've been collaborating quite a bit on the mini guide, and I think that APH has got an interest in that coming around. That is a really good device. It will not take the place of a cane because it will not detect a drop off. But you know, you can stick that mini guide in your pocket, or the hand guide either. All right, you can stick that cane, stick that in your pocket. Use your cane, and the cane's a good instrument. You know, I'm a big cane guy. But the problem with a cane is it's only going to tell you what it touches is out there. You know, you got to make contact with the cane before to know what's out there. And a dog guide, and I know how much you love dog guides. You know, they are great, but unless you're telling the dog to, you know, to look for something, that dog's not going to be, he's going to, it makes its living walking you around things, right?
Exactly.
Right? So you aren't going to know that something's out there if your dog guide's doing his job unless you're telling the dog to look for it, right? Mm-hmm. Am I correct?
You're exactly right.
All right, but here we've got these new secondary devices like the hand guide and the mini guide that can be put in your pocket, whether you're using a long cane or a dog guide, and pull it out and use it selectively. Like you're looking for that bus pole to catch the bus, or you're looking for that mailbox, or you're looking for that pedestrian, that what we call a ped head for street crossings, you know, for an audible street crossing. So you're looking for that. You don't have to misalign yourself with the traffic, you know, fumbling around for it. You, when you get in close proximity, you pull out your mini guide or your hand guide and do a quick and systematic scan around. You find it, and you go to it and do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. You count your landmarks. You're looking for doorways, intersecting hallways. Selective use, they are great. And it's an exciting time because you can get these devices very, very reasonably, I think.
Now, what about GPS?
Oh, GPS is another half of the game, and Alan Brooks and I, excuse me, from the United Kingdom are talking about a new classification system, because right now they're all classified in as electronic travel devices, which they may be, but one is a mobility aid and the other is a navigational aid.
Oh, good distinction.
Yeah, so the GPS and the Strider and you know, those things, they are, and they're excellent, but they are, you know, one is for detecting and previewing the environment, the other is to tell you where you are on the Earth's surface. So there is a distinction, you know, between, there needs to be two categories of electronic travel devices. One is a navigational aid and the other is a mobility device.
Tell me this, Bill, I know I have this problem and I'm sure I'm not the only one. It's very easy to totally lose your orientation, say in a big hall, even in a noisy traffic situation. You may cross a street and get confused and not realize that, say, you're not going north anymore. Is there, short of a compass, is there, because compasses have their drawbacks too, is there any, I think you'd call it a dead reckoning system to keep a person oriented?
Well, I'd like to comment on what you were saying there, especially with the compasses. And I was up at the Helen Keller Institute on Long Island just a couple of weeks ago to get a refresher training on working with individuals that are deafblind. And this one student that I was working with, I was using using a compass, and I told him the problem with a compass is sometimes a compass will lie to you. Mm-hmm. If you're close to a magnetic, you know, to a metal surface, it's going to, that north-seeking arrow is going to go to that magnetic surface. All right, so that is that's a problem with the compass. Now, as far as a dead reckoning system is concerned, and I think we're going to the same place here. I heard, and I've never seen one yet. I have never seen one yet, but I understand that there's a mobility device, an electronic travel device, that is now being field tested that will give you the navigational benefits, plus it will also help you with straight line travel.
Mm-mm.
That's got a compass built into it. And was that a flicker of a smile I saw of your face? You know what I'm talking about, right?
I do.
Yeah, and I've never seen one, but I want to get my hands on one, and I don't care what I have to do it. I want to get my hands on one so I can research it. But this may be, and I haven't like I say, I haven't seen it, but I'm very, very excited about this prospect.
Well, I am too, because to me it seems like that is one of the worst problems with blindness, is this whole total disorientation. You know,
sure.
The perfect example here in this building, you know, that fourth floor conference room we have up there, when it's full of people, you walk in there and go around the room a couple of times, there is no way you're going to know where that door is out of that room.
Exactly.
And if you had such a device, you know, you could point it to it when you went in there and say, that's where I want to go when I leave. And we need
so
that.
We are talking about that same device.
Yeah.
What is that device called?
Well, the things that we were calling it point of reference, because I was equating it to, you know, a person that's in a sandstorm in the desert where there's no there's no point of reference. There's no stars to look at, no horizon to line up with, you know. And you always hear the story when someone gets in this situation, they end up walking in circles for days or weeks or however long they can live because they don't have a point of reference. And
exactly.
That's the exact same situation we've
exactly.
got here.
And I understand you can take this device, the device that we're talking about, whatever the name it is, and you can adjust the tolerance for how much off of your line of travel that you're getting. Like if you're and it will tell you. You can narrow down the parameters of your path. Is that not correct?
Well, ideally, that would be the case. And I
that
guess
would also be great to have on street crossings.
Sure would. Absolutely.
Great to have. You don't know where I could get one of those devices. Look at it, do you?
I will say, Bill knows that we have been working on such a device, but the technical hurdles are currently insurmountable. We got it where you can make it fairly accurate most of the time, and as I did a lot more research into this and have gone to some conferences, I found out that there's actually some interest in such a device with, say, the U.S. Army, for instance. So they're trying to develop a similar thing, but it actually hadn't been done yet. And the reasons, they've used a lot of different techniques, accelerometers, gyroscopes, compass, all
exactly.
this together, altimeters even, and nobody's been able to my knowledge, to been able to come up with an accurate one for more than, you know, well, you have both time and amount of movement working against you. So the longer you use it and the more times you move around, the less chance that it's going to be perfect.
Dave Guth from Western Michigan University, they got a great program, and he's been in the field a long time. I've known him from Peabody, but even when he was at Peabody back in the 80s, he was very interested in the straight-line travel aspect of this, and he was experimenting with gyroscopes, and I think he still probably is for the straight line travel. And that, what a boon that would be! Because you know, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, but like when I did my dissertation, like 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, it was 6 years ago because I got my doctorate 5 years ago. When I did my dissertation, I was doing spatial organization.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, believe me, I saw how 40 homogeneous subjects with no other disability other than their blindness, travel. And I saw a great, great, great amount of variance. And it was, you know, I think that the straight line travel aspect was probably as significant as any extraneous variable that we isolated in that research.
Was that right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, because how many times have you seen people get hung up in parking lots?
Yeah. Well,
and depending on whether the traffic is on your parallel street is going to depend on how you work your way out of it.
Right, and you're using that as your point of reference.
That's correct. You're walking beside that parallel mm-hmm. traffic. And if something happens, if you veer into a parking lot where the sound of your parallel street is occluded, or it happens to be your upcoming intersecting street is just as loud from where you are in that parking lot, say it's a corner parking lot, you can very, very, very easily become disoriented.
Absolutely.
Yeah, those things can happen.
Yaroslav, can I ask you to talk a little bit about training for blind people in the Eastern Bloc countries? Can you tell us?
I don't have the precise knowledge about other countries, but Poland. There's two types, two basic types of training. One is just a regular 5-year master's program. Where you take all different classes, vision classes and orientation mobility classes. And after the first 3 years, you choose whether you want to specialize in teaching students with visual impairment or in orientation mobility. So that's for those who want to do their degrees in those two fields. But there are also programs that they're called postmasters or post-diploma programs that prepare teachers or people who already have their masters in different fields to work with students with visual impairments. Those programs right now last for 3 semesters. And unlike here in the United States, they are not so much composed of separate classes, though there are separate components within the programs. And the students are taught about psychology, about teaching methods, about daily living skills, also intro to orientation mobility, assistive technology, and obviously Braille. So right now, as of today, teachers working in Poland with well, students with different disabilities need to have relevant preparation, whether it be master's or this post-master's programs.
Okay. And talk to us about technology in Poland. Is it, I know I hear a lot of stories about the Europeans having, you know, far better cell phone capabilities than we do. Is that the case in Poland?
Yeah, well, it is because it's unified. You know, it's the same across Europe. Unlike here in the United States, you go from state to state, and the systems differ. So, to that respect, yes, it's well, we can call it the better or better functioning. It is, even in Poland you see and you hear lots of people talking on the cell phones, though unlike in the United States, they're not allowed to talk on the cell phones when they're driving.
Is that right?
Which is a huge difference.
Otherwise,
technology is pretty well advanced, and even in countries like Poland right now, we are very much up to date with the latest technology. The school I worked for, when I was leaving, we had 3 full-fledged computer laboratories with 10 to 12 computers each, and each computer had screen reader and refreshable Braille display.
And what screen readers were you all using?
Well, in Poland, mainly people use Window Eyes. That's because the company or Polish equivalent the partner of GW Micro has done a much better job with the Polish language.
Okay.
I'm more inclined into JAWS, but as far as Polish language and JAWS, there are lots of conflicts. So Window Eyes is much more popular.
Interesting. Is there anything that I should be asking you that I'm not, that you would like to tell people that are listening to this?
Well, it's a very exciting time that I'm having here in the United States. I've learned quite a lot. I'm also giving my knowledge that I brought from Europe. I wish, you know, people could really freely travel and live in different respective countries and continents, because it really helps our end client, which is our students, to get better services.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely it's a two-way road, and both sides would benefit, and I'm sure benefiting from that exchange.
Well, you know, one thing along those lines is this whole idea that a lot of the libraries in the different countries are going to these digital talking books and the DAISY. Is that the case with the Polish Library for the Blind or whatever it is called?
Yes, we do have Library for the Blind. And I unfortunately must say that they're not so technologically advanced that they could, because, you know, the resources are there, but maybe not financial ones.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the problem lies.
Mm-hmm.
I know that University of Warsaw, in cooperation with the National Library, have been preparing for the last 5 years digital collection of books in Polish but in digital format. They might also be start working on books in other languages, because National Library has a huge collection of all different books from all over the world.
Hmm.
So there are such projects. The school I work for in Poland also launched its own project making a digital library for people with visual impairments. They started collecting books about 3 years ago. I'm not sure how the project is going right now. But I know that they had some difficulties, but I also know that there are already people who are using whatever is available at the moment in the library. You need to be legally blind and you register to receive those books.
Hmm. What about, you mentioned Window Eyes supported Polish better earlier. What about in the way of the speech synthesizer itself? Is there an eloquence that is specific to the Polish language, or is there more than one synthesizer?
There's more than one synthesizer. The most popular is called Kubusz, which is like James as a name. There is no real equivalent of
eloquence.
Eloquence, right. So that's the biggest problem. I know that there's at least one or two institutes that are working on improving those Polish synthesized voice, but so far they haven't really moved far. Especially when I compare to like Natural Voices AT&T, and I'm really looking forward to now Window Eyes with JAWS using the similar type of voices for these screen readers.
Yeah. Now, is this one you mentioned? Is it a software synthesizer?
It is software synthesizer.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, so. Yeah. The Spanish version of AT&T Natural Voices is uncanny. It sounds human. Well, the English one isn't too bad either.
Yeah, and actually, I think British sounds a little bit better than American.
Yeah,
surprisingly.
Yeah. Now, is Polish a language that has few enough exceptions that it's feasible to do a good synthesized speech?
Unfortunately not.
Oh, yeah,
it's extremely complex morphologically, the language, with gender endings, with numerous declensions and conjugations. So it's much harder to do a really good and solid synthesizer, like the English.
I see. anything else you want to tell our listeners, Bill or Yaroslav?
Well, I would certainly be remiss if I didn't give a plug for the University of Louisville Distance Ed Visual Impairment Program. And if you have any interest in becoming certified as a teacher of the visually impaired, and you have a teaching certificate already and you want to add to the certification, all you have to do is email me at wpenrod@Louisville, that's Louisville.edu, and I'll be happy to send you information on our program.
And do you have a contact email, Yaroslav?
Yes, it's the longest email ever. I don't know why they did it, it's MPS's email, why they haven't shortened it and made some alias. It's, try to remember, it's wiazoj@mail, which is mail, dot Milwaukee, mailwukee, if I spell it right, dot k12 dot wi dot us. I'm going to try to say it again, wiazowj@mail dot Milwaukee dot k12 dot wi dot us.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. This has been a really informative conversation, and I know the listeners will enjoy hearing this. And this concludes issue 15 of Blind Cool Tech. You can leave a comment for us on our comment line at 206-984-9203. We're at www.aph.org/tech/bct.htm. See you next time.